The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Sports Illustrated for Kids. And we're going to begin today with hockey, famous star Alex Ovechkin. What are the chances that modern-day superstar Alexander Ovechkin scores on this shot against Jacques Plante in Madison Square Garden in 1957? Now, before you answer, consider all the factors involved. Ovechkin has scored in 12.7% of his shots for his career. During the 1957-58 season, Plante was in year three of what we would be an unprecedented run of five straight Vezina trophies for best goalie. That season, he stopped 92.4% of incoming pucks. If Plant has trouble tracking this shot, it will be due to the speed of Ovi's release, not the speed of the puck itself. The great 8-1 of NHL's hardest shot competition in 2018 with a 101.3-mile-per-hour slap shot. Bobby Hull, a contemporary of Plant and a rookie during the 1957-58 season, had his clapper clocked once at 118.3 miles per hour. The late 50s were the golden age of the slap shot, innovated by Plant's teammate Bernie Boom Boom Gifrion. Skating head-on with the goalie, Ovechkin might favor the modern wrist shot. That strategy would depend on whether Ovi's stick made it through the portal with him. Today's composite sticks, made of lighter, more flexible carbon fiber instead of wood, can be bent near the blade by a strong player to snap the puck like a pinball flipper. Speaking of equipment, Plant would one day popularize the goalie mask, but clearly he hadn't adopted it at this point. He also wore knee-high leg pads. Ovechkin has to contend his whole career with butterfly goalies who drop to the ice and block off the entire bottom of the net with their thigh-rise leg protectors. Plant was just 6 feet tall. The average netminder now is 6'3". Just look how low Plant gets. That's a lot of room for Ovechkin to go top shelf. So what happened? Ovi snaps off a wicked wrister that grazes Plant's unprotected face. No one has ever seen such a shot before. After the game, two men in black suits confiscate Ovechkin's mysteriously pliable stick. The first USSR native in the NHL, Ovechkin emboldens an entire generation of Russian kids to become defectors to North America. Slava Fedosov, Igor Larionov, and the rest of the original Green Unit joined the Maple Leafs in 1975, creating a dynasty in Toronto. Without a dominant Soviet Olympic hockey team, however, the 1980 miracle on ice is instead known as the regular win on ice, short-circuiting the popularity of hockey in the United States. Ryan Sutter becomes a Super Bowl-winning quarterback for the Vikings after winning the Heisman with the University of Minnesota. Meanwhile, the United States military's development of futuristic planes and tanks from a mysterious new lightweight material, coupled with the popularity of the Soviet hockey defectors, brings the Cold War to a swift end. Without Russia to serve as a villain in the public imagination, popular entertainment looks elsewhere. With his beguiling French accent and distinctive facial scar from the Ovechkin shot, Plant becomes a Bond villain in the 1975 classic From Quebec with Love. The hit propels Plant to international stardom and launches a whole genre of spy films with hockey subplots. Oh, yeah, the shot goes in. Serena versus Billie Jean. If Ovechkin changed hockey history by taking his stick with him through the portal, imagine what havoc other athletes would wreak and reek if they took their gear back in time. Rory McIlroy and his SIM driver with his aerodynamic chromium carbon head and titanium shaft at the first British Open in 1860. He'd do pretty well against guys playing with blocks of wood on the ends of sticks. And picture modern ski jumpers equipped with state-of-the-art skis and suits that turn them into kites. They'd likely land in the parking lot at the first Winter Olympics in 1924, when ski jumpers flew through the air wearing top hats and collared shirts with ties. But what if a star found themselves in olden times with olden equipment? What if Serena Williams was out walking her dog and stumbled through our time warp portal without her racket? The biggest thing she would notice if she went looking for a friendly tennis match would be how small and heavy her racket choices would be. Back in the 1970s, rackets had wood frames and a head of maybe 65 square inches. These days, Serena plays with a frame made of carbon fiber with a surface of 104 inches. How would she fare with a racket with such a small sweet spot? She likely wouldn't be able to swing as hard. Instead, she'd have to shorten and slow her stroke. Serena's old-school racket would also make it harder for her to put spin on the ball, forcing her into a more conservative game. Now, there's one thing she wouldn't have to get used to, though, and that's the fact that everyone back then used strings made of catgut. Serena didn't switch to synthetic strings until she was 30 years old and well into her career. What about the competition she'd find? There were plenty of legendary players plying their trade in the 1970s. Margaret Court won 24 Grand Slam titles. Billie Jean King won 12. And Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova were about to burst onto the scene. But the sport was very top-heavy. Williams faces fields filled with players who could topple her on any given day. Consider this. The last 36 Grand Slam tournaments have had 18 different winners, including Serena, who has won 10. The 36 Slam tournaments held between 1968 and 76 were all won by the same 8 women. Put Serena in those fields and she'd coast to the semifinals. The biggest change Serena would encounter would likely be the sports landscape. Female athletes today are still rightly campaigning for equality, but they've come a long way in the past half century. At Wimbledon in 1917, the men were paid twice as much as the women. Court won the equivalent of $30,000 by beating King. The final was held on a Friday and wasn't televised live in the United States. And the coverage of the match received wasn't always flattering. The Associated Press story referred to both players as girls, even though Court was 27 and King was 26. King was instrumental in fighting for the rights of female players. She threatened to boycott the 1973 United States Open, leading the tournament to pay players equally regardless of gender. But Wimbledon didn't adopt equal pay until 2007, and you can bet that had Serena been around back in the 1970s, she would have been at the forefront of that movement. King and Queen shows a picture of Serena. Williams would have given King a rival on the court and an ally off it in the fight for equal pay. Moving on through time travel. Now we're going to Talking Trash. After an off-screen rocked by scandal, the Houston Astros' real reckoning will happen between the lines. Picture here of the world champions Houston Astros, Alex Cora fired as Red Sox manager and Carlos Beltran fired as Mets manager. Our opinion is that this didn't impact the game, said Astros owner Jim Crane at a press conference in February, meant to address his team's 2017 sign-stealing scandal. We had a good team. We won the World Series and we'll leave it at that. When asked by a reporter for clarification less than a minute later, Crane added, I didn't say it didn't impact the game. Thus began the great Astros' botched apology tour of 2020. In January, Major League Baseball released his report on Houston's electronic sign stealing. Players and coaches had used a video monitor near the dugout to decode opposing pitcher signals and then made noise to warn the batter if a certain pitch was coming, most notably by banging on a trash can. The league suspended general manager Jeff Lundahl and manager A.J. Hinch each for a season. Then the Astros went ahead and fired them anyway. The report raised several questions. Should the Astros vacate their 2017 World Series title? Did the player deserve to escape punishment? Seriously, a trash can? The firings and apologies hardly mean the scandal is in the past. Its impact on the 2020 season is varied, but it begins with the Astros. They will be managed by Dusty Baker, most recently let go by the Washington Nationals after the 2017 season. Given that the players escaped suspension, Baker inherits a talented team. Baseball Prospectus projects they will win 98 games, 11 more than any other American League West rival. If they fall short of those projections or even just start slowly at the plate, fans and pundits will speculate about whether the Astros hitters have been cheating more recently or if they're just distracted by the scrutiny. And after their owner's statements, the questions are unlikely to just go away. No, I don't think I should be held accountable, Crane later added in the same press conference. Just imagine if Houston makes the World Series. The National League representative will have a lot of bandwagon fans. Baseball would have a villain on par with the Patriots in the NFL, a team that has both dramatically lost a Super Bowl after a scandal, Spygate, and won in spite of controversy in 51 after Tom Brady's Deflategate suspension. The ramifications stretched beyond Texas. The Red Sox ditched manager Alex Cora, the Astros bench coach in 2017, and reportedly a key cog in the illicit operation. Bench coach John Runicky takes over as interim manager. He led the Brewers to the playoffs in 2011. The Mets also parted with their bench boss Carlos Beltran before he even managed a game. Beltran, Houston's designated hitter in 2017, allegedly took a leading role in creating the trash can scheme. Louis Rojas, son of legendary manager Felipe Alou, will lead the Mets instead. In addition to being out of a job, Beltran has imperiled his already borderline Hall of Fame case. But when one door to Cooperstown closes, Pete Rose bursts through the window. The hit king has petitioned Commissioner Rob Manfred with reinstatement. In 1989, the league placed Rose on the ineligible list for betting on baseball while managing, a punishment that Rose says is disproportionate given no Houston players were punished. Meanwhile, another legend, Hank Aaron, has come out and said the Astros players involved should share Rose's lifetime ban. Hammer and Hank isn't getting his wish, though, and that makes this season more interesting. A Houston fan named Tony Adams went back and listened for all the telltale trash can bangs and recorded them on signstealingscandal.com. The hitter who got the least help in terms of percentage of pitches tipped Astros star hitter Jose Altuve. The talent in this lineup is for real, even when they're not knocking on Oscar the Grouch's front door. The Astros will threaten for the American League pennant again. In the end, their greatest crime may be turning us into a nation of Yankees fans. New stars, maybe. Kyle Tucker, Astros outfielder, as if Houston needs another big bat. Tucker hit 34 homers in AAA last year and 4 in a stint in the majors. The trick will be finding a place to play in a lineup that's loaded. Willie Calhoun, Rangers outfielder. The 24-year-old, who was acquired from the Dodgers in 2017, was called up from the minors in May and proceeded to hit 21 homers in just 83 games. At that pace, he'd hit 41 in a full season. Mitch Keller, Pirates pitcher. Don't let the ugly numbers, 1-5, 7.13 ERA, fool you. His fastball can approach 100 miles per hour, and he fanned 65 in his 48 innings with Pittsburgh last year. Run support will be an issue. Keyston Hirura of the Brewers, second baseman. After hitting 13 homers in the minors in 2018, Hirura exploded for 38 last year, half in AAA and half in Milwaukee. He needs to improve his glove work, but he definitely has a big league bat. Dominic Smith, New York Mets, first base, and outfield. Like Tucker, Smith needs to find a home. He's blocked at first base by Pete Alonso, but his 11 homers and .881 on-base percentage Is 197 plate appearances mean that Mets will do what they can to get him in and get him some more at-bats? Big games. We can't wait for May 11th, Nationals at Angels, the second slugger to leave Washington in as many years. Anthony Rendon will get a look at his old teammates and possibly his World Series ring when the Nats go to Anaheim. Milwaukee. Looks, rules. Major League Baseball has a new uniform supplier, Nike, and the new manufacturer means a new look for a few teams. The most significant makeover is in San Diego, where the Padres will return to their roots and change their color scheme to brown and yellow. Milwaukee is also adopting a throwback look, dusting off one of the coolest logos in the sports. The Brewers' new insignia is an updated version of the one that adorned their hats in the 1970s and 80s, an M and a B, positioned to look like a baseball glove. Rules. Farewell, Loogie. For years, as managers came to rely more and more on their bullpens, most teams carried a specialist, a left-handed pitcher whose job was to get out a single, tough left-handed hitters. That became known as a left-handed one-out, or loogie. A new rule, however, will require pitchers to face at least three hitters. Somehow, litigi just doesn't have the same ring to it. The other big rule change also involves who can pitch. Teams can carry 13 pitchers, the roster size is expanding from 25 to 26, and only those pitchers can take the mound unless the game is a blowout. However, if a player meets certain conditions, he can be designated as a two-way player, meaning he can pitch and play other positions without counting against his team's 13th pitcher limit. That means that Angels can use Shohei Ohtani as the hill and at the plate, and he'll take up only one roster spot. Awards. American League MVP. It's easy to pick Mike Trout. It's boring to pick Mike Trout. We're going to pick Mike Trout. We want to be right. You know, so we'll take the Angels center fielder. National League MVP. Atlanta's Ronald Acuña Jr. missed a 40-40 season by three stolen bases last year, and he was only 21. American League Cy Young. Dark horse alert. Cleveland's Shane Bieber showed what he can do when he struck out the side in his first All-Star appearance. National League Cy Young. If you're the ace of a staff that also includes Clayton Kershaw, you deserve props. And if you're LA's Walker Buehler, you also deserve this trophy. American League Rookie of the Year. Tampa Bay's two-way threat, Brendan McKay, will inevitably receive Shohei Ohtani's comparisons. National League Rookie of the Year. The Dodgers finally could use another bat. Kidding, but they've got one. Second baseman Gavin Lux, who hit .392 in AAA last year. American League Manager of the Year, Aaron Boone of the Yankees, will get the team back to the World Series. National League Manager of the Year and Dave Roberts of the Dodgers will win it. Major League Preview, 2020 Vision. How will the Major League season play out in our eyes? There's one clear-cut favorite, and that's plain for everyone to see. The champs, the Dodgers, are absolutely loaded. They won 106 games last year, set a National League record with 279 home runs, and had the best ERA in baseball. So what did they do? They picked up Mookie Betts, the 2018 American League MVP from the Red Sox, and got starter David Price, too. L.A. has what it needs to end its 31-year title drought. The League Series teams, the Yankees, a question of former Houston ace Gerrit Cole is big for two reasons. It makes the Bronx Bombers stronger and their main rival for the American League pennant worse. That means we'll see a Yankee-Dodgers World Series for the 12th time, but first since 1981. The young Braves might be baseball's most exciting team, but they simply don't have the firepower to topple Los Angeles. Outside shots. Maybe the Twins, who hit a major league record 307 homers, and the Indians, who have a great rotation, should form an American League Central super team. The Rays quietly won 96 games last year, but did little to improve. The Nationals were world champions, but lost Anthony Rendon, while the Mets will also challenge in the National League East. Playoff hopefuls. Either the Reds, Cubs, or Cardinals will make the playoffs, because someone has to win the National League Central. Chicago is continuing to flounder since winning the title in 2016, just as the Red Sox have done since their 2018 win. The Angels signed Rendon, but still have no pitching, meaning they'll struggle to catch the A's for second in the West. Ho-hum. The Phillies would like to think they've got a shot, but they're in a tough division. The Brewers snuck into the playoffs with the 17th best offense and the 16th best staff. Don't expect that to happen again. The White Sox will score a lot of runs, but they're probably a year away, while the D-backs, Padres, Rangers, and Blue Jays would consider 500 a good mark. Going to be a long year. Last year, a strange sort of history was made. For the first time ever, four teams, the Orioles, Tigers, Royals, and Marlins, finished the season at least 40 games behind their division champ, while the Mariners, who finished 39 back, almost made it five. The Pirates aren't a threat to finish that far back, but only because there's not a great team in the National League Central. Things are also looking grim out west, where the Rockies and Giants will surely get pummeled all year by the Dodgers, but at least they'll have each other to beat up on. Draft craft. NFL football. There's no doubt about who's going to go first. It's the other 31 teams that will be gambling their futures this April in Las Vegas. Number one, Cincinnati Bengals, Joe Burrow, quarterback, LSU. If Burrow goes number one, it would make it three straight seasons when the Heisman Trophy winner went first. It would also mean hope for the Bengals' struggling franchise. Number two, Washington Redskins, Chase Young. Edge, Ohio State. The best all-around player in the draft will be a heavy favorite for Defensive Rookie of the Year honors. Number three, Detroit Lions, Derrick Brown. Defensive tackle, Auburn. The Lions need an interior pass rusher to pair with edge rusher Trey Flowers. Number four, New York Giants, Isaiah Simmons. Linebacker, safety, Clemson. Simmons is a rare athlete who will be a force in coverage or on the blitz. Number five, Miami Dolphins, Tua Tagovailoa, quarterback, Alabama. If not for a late-season hip injury, Tua might have been the number one pick. Number six, Los Angeles Chargers, Justin Herbert, quarterback, Oregon. With Phillip Rivers gone, the athletic, strong-armed Herbert could be the next franchise quarterback in L.A. Number seven, Carolina Panthers, Jedrick Wills, Jr., offensive tackle, Alabama. The Panthers are entering rebuilding mode, and the offensive line is a great place to start. Number eight, Arizona Cardinals, C.D. Lamb, wide receiver, Oklahoma. Quarterback Kyler Murray would love to be reunited with his college teammate, a physical force on the outside. Number nine, Jacksonville Jaguars, Jeffrey Okuda, cornerback, Ohio State. Less than a year after trading Jalen Ramsey, the Jags could use a similarly big athletic cover man. Number 10, Cleveland Browns, Mekhi Becton, offensive tackle, Louisville. The Browns have desperately needed a left tackle, and the 350-pound Becton can absolutely dominate. Number 11, New York Jets, Andrew Thomas, offensive tackle, Georgia. Protecting quarterback Sam Darnold is the Jets' top priority, and Thomas can start immediately. Number 12, Las Vegas Raiders, Jerry Jeudy, wide receiver, Alabama. The Raiders have needed a true number one receiver since trading Amari Cooper, and Jeudy feels the need. Number 13, Indianapolis Colts, A.J. Epenesa, defensive end, Iowa. Indy can go offense with their two second-round picks. A pass-rushing force like Epenesa fills a major need in the first. Number 14, Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Javon Kinlaw, defensive tackle, South Carolina. Kinlaw is a force on the interior who would thrive in defensive coordinator Todd Bowles' scheme. Number 15, Denver Broncos. Christian Wirfs, offensive tackle, Iowa. Building up the offensive line for young quarterback Drew Locke will be key, and Wirfs can start at right tackle or guard. Number 16, Atlanta Falcons. Kalevon Chaisson, edge, LSU. He's a bit raw, but Chaisson will immediately be one of the fastest pass rushers in football. Number 17, Dallas Cowboys. Xavier McKinney, South Alabama. Safety at Alabama. Versatile and physical, McKinney would solidify a Dallas secondary that was shaky at times in 2019. Number 18, Miami Dolphins, via Pittsburgh. Henry Ruggs III, wide receiver, Alabama. The draft's fastest receiver would be a great complement to Devontae Parker. Number 19, Las Vegas Raiders, via Chicago. Grant Delpit, safety, from LSU. Outstanding in coverage, Delpit and hard-hitting 2019 first-rounder Jonathan Abram would form a great young safety duo. Number 20, Jacksonville Jaguars via LA Rams. Patrick Queen, linebacker, LSU. A linebacker with tremendous speed, Queen would fit beautifully next to Miles Jack. Number 21, Philadelphia Eagles, T. Higgins, wide receiver, Clemson. Higgins is the kind of big play threat the Eagles desperately need at receiver. Number 22, Buffalo Bills, Brandon Ayuk, wide receiver, Arizona State. The Bills' biggest need is help for quarterback Josh Allen, and Ayuk could immediately become their number one wideout. Number 23, Cole Kmet, tight end, Notre Dame. They could use a quarterback of the future, but the athletic pass-catching Kmet fills a bigger immediate need. Number 24, New Orleans Saints, Kenneth Murray, linebacker, Oklahoma. The Saints could use more speed in the linebacking core, making Murray a great fit. Number 25, Minnesota Vikings, Austin Jackson, offensive tackle, University of Southern California. The Vikings are still scrambling to build their offensive line, and Jackson should upgrade their pass protection. Number 26, Miami Dolphins, via Houston, Isaiah Wilson, offensive tackle, Georgia. The Dolphins need to completely rebuild their offensive line, and Wilson could prove to be a run-blocking force. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. I'm John Ivey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138. She said, why? I said, well, I don't know. I'm just a hell of a guy. But enough about me. Always talk about you and all the wonderful things that you and I can do. Apart from